Lawmakers in Ohio are considering House Bill 197 that would accelerate the growth of community solar development in a statewide pilot program. Meanwhile, large-scale solar power farms have been greenlit for construction in the state, while incentives are being developed to get solar power cheaper and more accessible for homeowners. And just today, the Biden administration announced Ohio will receive over $300 million in federal funding to expand solar programs. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll celebrate Earth Day and kick off a week of environmental conversations by talking about the growth of solar power in Ohio. Later, we'll talk about the newly named Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2024 inductees, including Cher, Dave Matthews Band, and A Tribe Called Quest. We have those conversations coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us, and a happy Monday to all of you. This week, House Bill 197 will have a hearing in the Ohio State House in Columbus. HB 197 is a bipartisan-backed bill that would create a pioneering statewide community solar program. A clean energy project like that would create more than 27,000 jobs and create over $400 million in state revenue over its lifetime. That's according to a study from Ohio University. And just this morning, big news, the Biden-Harris administration announced $7 billion in solar for all grants, with more than $156 million going to the state of Ohio and another $156 million going to Growth Opportunities Partners, a group here in Northeast Ohio. In honor of Earth Day today, The Sound of Ideas is going to feature a week of environmentally focused discussions on the show. Today, we will focus on the latest regarding solar energy and news in the state, as well as what the federal government is doing to make solar more affordable for homes and businesses. Later in the show, stay with us. We'll talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class of 2024. But first, let's talk solar power. And with me in studio to do that is Tristan Rader. He's the Ohio Program Director for Solar United Neighbors. Tristan, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
And we also have Kathy Ann Kowalski in the studio. She is a reporter for the Energy News Network. Kathy Ann, welcome to the show. Great to see you again.
Glad to be here.
If you'd like to join the conversation, have a question or thought about the use or expansion of solar energy in the state of Ohio or locally, call 866-578-0903. That's 866-578-0903. You can shoot us an email at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Tristan, let's talk about this very big news, seemingly, from the Biden administration. Over $300 million in federal grants to Ohio as part of this Solar for All program. What are these dollars going towards, and how will they be used?
Sure. This is unprecedented investment in clean energy, and particularly the Solar for All program is meant for people of 200% of poverty or below, people that are experiencing very high energy burden. In the city of Cleveland specifically, that's a lot of people that are experiencing very high energy burden. Energy burden is your significant part of your income is going to pay for utilities. So this money is dedicated to adding solar to the rooftops of low-income individuals, particularly in places like Cleveland, and also doing community solar projects. These are projects that are allow for many people to subscribe to a solar array, maybe renters that don't have space on their roof, to subscribe to a local solar array that maybe the municipal utility would facilitate. And they can save money and get renewable, reliable energy from those projects.
And Kathy Ann, when you talk about $7 billion nationally being allocated, and a lot of that funding presumably is going towards organizations or initiatives that deal with allowing solar energy to be accessible for lower income, let's say communities of color that are historically more disenfranchised, what is the Biden administration trying to say about the use of solar energy in this country?
I mean, two things. One, it's a source of clean energy that does not add greenhouse gas emissions once it's built. And so it's a way to substitute for some of the carbon-based power that's currently being used. And number two, This was part of the Inflation Reduction Act, and as Tristan said, these families that will be getting this have high energy burdens, so it really does rein in inflation for those people. And it's basically kind of a two-shot, one to help people in their pocketbooks and one to help the environment.
And let's be clear, I asked you this right before we went on, but in Ohio, the bulk of the energy that we get is from natural gas. Is that right?
That is correct.
And where does natural gas sit on kind of the pyramid of fossil fuels and the pollutant quality of natural gas?
Okay. Natural gas is not as dirty as coal when it comes to some of the additional pollutants that come out or the amount of carbon dioxide that you get. However, natural gas itself, when you burn it, does give off carbon dioxide, and natural gas that emits is, natural gas is methane. Methane is a more potent greenhouse gas, at least in the short term, than carbon dioxide. So it's still pretty polluting when you're thinking about climate change.
And for those like yourself, Tristan, who are all on board for solar power, where does solar power stand? I mean, you still have to deal with the creation of panels and the manufacturing and whatnot. But where does solar power, in your perspective, stand on kind of the pyramid of clean to dirty energy?
Sure. I think it's an absolutely essential part of this clean energy transition. You know, you mentioned solar taking resources to make, and it does, but solar is extremely durable. Panels that are produced today will last 30-plus years. Panels that are 30 years old, you know, the solar's been around a while, are still plugging away, producing energy for the folks that are using them. So it's a technology that'll be around for a very long time, and the more we use it, I think the proof's in the pudding. You know, solar that's been out there for a long time is still producing, and the solar that's going up today will be producing many, many decades into the future.
Because once the arrays are built, for the most part, the energy transmission creation is clean.
That's right. And there's no moving parts. It's a very, actually, pretty simple technology. It just sits there and it produces energy without much other input besides the sun.
Okay, let's talk about community solar for a bit, because that relates to what is going on in the Ohio State House. So let's talk about House Bill 197 and what community solar does for a region.
Yeah, we're very excited about this House bill, and it seems to have a lot of momentum. It's a bipartisan bill. It's actually led by some Republicans are leading this effort in Columbus, because they know that solar energy, especially that distributed, local-grown solar energy, is a great way for our state to become more energy independent. And we definitely see this as something that many people can tap into. In the bill, there's guaranteed savings, so that folks that are able to subscribe to these solar arrays around the state will actually get a little bit of savings in their bill when they subscribe to those projects. So it's really essential, I think, to grow our energy portfolio here in the state.
And where is this already happening? I mean, you talk about proof being in the pudding. Are we seeing this being implemented in successful ways?
Yes. 22 states right now have community solar projects. In fact, I think 4 or 5 states just last year made their pilot programs permanent. This is just a pilot program, but it still would represent a doubling of the solar we have in the state if we were able to pass this.
And Kathy Ann, what has your reporting led you to when it comes to community solar and maybe the politics around House Bill 197?
It's been tried several times before and had not made it across the finish line. So it's always iffy, I think, to try to get it passed in one house and then the other house, and that takes some resolve on the part of leadership. And unfortunately, I think there's been a tendency on the part of some people in leadership to either be against solar or to favor fossil fuels. So we're going to have to see what happens, but it would be great if it could pass.
Can you elaborate more on that tension and why you think there is lawmaker adherence to the older energy sources that we are used to being reliant on?
Well, when I put together an analysis like 3 or 4 years ago, looking at the amount of political contributions coming in from the fossil fuel industries and utilities, That was the largest identifiable group after you got past general lobbyists and the political parties and other unknowns. Like, it's a big chunk of political backing.
Do you think 197 might have legs?
I hope so. I mean, the people I've talked to have been very positive about the bill. The only opponents against it so far are the Ohio Consumers Council, which generally does not like anything that's going to add a rider to people's bills. And then also American Electric Power, which is a large utility.
Let's take a call from Alan in Oberlin. Alan, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I read about a year and a half or so ago in the Ohio Capital Journal that the state passed a law in 2021 that would allow counties to ban construction of large-scale solar arrays outside of corporate boundaries on a county-by-county basis. And at that time, they said that there were about 10 counties that had done so, and I believe you all reported a couple of weeks ago that Mahoning County joined that list.
Alan, thanks so much for your thought and question. And Kathy Ann, I'll turn that to you. What about counties or individual jurisdictions and their ability to ban wind and solar in the state?
The law that the caller is referring to is known as Senate Bill 52. It does, in fact, say that. It is an extra hurdle that wind and solar projects face that does not apply to natural gas or coal or basically anything else. We have seen it being brought up in a number of cases. There are several instances in which older projects that were already in the pipeline were grandfathered, putting that in quotes, meaning, for example, the county can't ban them, but they get to have a township and a county trustee serve as ad hoc representatives at the Ohio Power Siting Board. And we've got some cases pending that discuss just what that all means and what the public interest means in these cases. So it's a very big area of debate right now.
Yeah, and Tristan, I mean, what are organizations and this kind of network of solar energy supporters doing in regards to legislation that you feel might be preventative of having solar energy expand in the state?
Yeah, we're getting together. I mean, around House Bill 197, there's just like literally thousands of people across the state. And on our list, we've activated around 1,000 folks that have sent letters to their representatives, and people just really want to be able to produce their own energy on their own land, whether that's a larger type size array. We're talking about private land. People should be able to do what they want to do on their own land or their roofs. They should be able to put solar in their roofs or in their parks, and they should be able to receive the benefit of that energy. I think that's a very clear sort of message. I think people get it. When we talk about community solar, we don't really even have to explain it very much because people know kind of intrinsically what that means. It's solar that is community developed, it's benefiting the community, and it's also leading towards a clean energy transition and getting us away from fossil fuels.
But that fundamental tension is there, because then if you're getting your energy from solar power, you are not getting it from historically the big companies that seem to provide almost all the energy in the state.
Correct. And there's where you see your battle lines drawn between the people who want to just produce energy themselves and the legacy utilities and legacy fossil fuel industry.
But then to kind of flip this on its head, we do see a tension towards solar power that is different in dynamics. And in some more rural parts of our state, big scale utility solar farms are being greenlit for development. And the controversy of those have been, we don't want our land turned into a big solar power array. Can you talk about how that has played out with some of these farms? Let's first start with Knox County.
Okay.
And what the tension has been between residents and the would-be developers of this utility farm.
Knox County is a developing case for this Fraser Solar Project. Open Road Renewables is the developer. There are actually two opposition groups involved. One is kind of your local homegrown opposition group, people that just don't want it in their community, don't want it next to them. Talk about the character, or they don't want the hassles of the construction, etc. Then there's another group that was incorporated as a for-profit LLC, limited liability corporation, right after the application was filed, that is not disclosing the source of its funding, but seems to be fairly well funded. And some of the speakers that have occurred at their programs have ties to fossil fuel groups. And so, you know, they're saying we don't want to turn this whole land, you know, into a big giant solar array, and we want the value of our farmland to continue. At the same time, I've talked with, you know, people in the community who are like, hey, it's your property. If you want to lease it, you should be able to lease it. There are farmers who have intervened in the case who have said, hey, we want to lease our property. This is how we keep it in the family. And also, this is how we keep this from turning into yet another Columbus suburb an hour away from the city, because you can actually remove solar panels if you want. So it's ongoing tension. A public hearing at the beginning of this month went to 11:30 at night, and they still hadn't heard from half the people. So they've got two more hearings scheduled to listen to those people for May.
But it's interesting. And to be fair, there does seem to be a lot of residential resistance to, you know, the creation of these solar power farms. And you've got to wonder, you know, is there truth in kind of the change in personality to land or a region when it's covered by solar power panels? Or do you think that's just the way it is, and this energy is clean and you know, is in some ways forward moving for the state? But it does seem like there has been a lot of kind of community resistance. I'm thinking about Oak Run and all the articles I've read about the hearings and the resistance from community members to it. And so I wonder, really, what is the crux of the tension there?
Oak Run is a long decision. I believe it exceeded 100 pages. When I read it, it was very well reasoned and went through all the different factors that were being brought up. And this is one of those grandfathered cases. It's the largest solar project in the state at 800 megawatts.
6,000 acres.
It's big. But one of the things, to answer your question about, you know, is this going to change the whole nature of the community, is that last year the Ohio Power Siting Board adopted new rules that call for setbacks from property lines and residential property and roads, and what they call rural appropriate fencing and camouflage. So there really does seem to be some effort on the part of the board to address these issues. Now, how that's going to play out, I'm not sure. There are two cases pending at the Ohio Supreme Court right now about what is the public interest. And is it a straw poll of however many people show up to complain? Or does it require more expertise and weighing on the part of the board? And we have to see what gets decided.
Let's go ahead and bring in Shaniqua Gibson. She's joining us by phone. She's the Ohio State Director for Action for the Climate Emergency. Shaniqua, thanks for calling in.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Shaniqua, the Action for Climate Emergency is a nonprofit that's involved in education advocacy and policy guidance. How is ACE working on solar issues, particularly here in Ohio?
Yeah, so with ACE, our main focus is high school youth, and that's my main focus, I would say. But ACE as an organization, we're focused on youth, and youth defined as in ACE is usually from about the voting youth is from 18 to about 30, 34, loosely. So what we're doing in Ohio, one, is we have a really strong digital presence. So we're using our digital presence for ads and things like that, and using different type of tactics to not only lead with like a climate focus, but more so to point out the benefits of solar in counties like Knox County, where it's very rural and maybe climate isn't their main focus. So we're talking about like the economic benefits and things like that. And we're also doing a lot of education with our youth, even before they're of voting age, to help them to understand like why this is beneficial and all of the intersections between like not only producing your own power, but the economic benefits and the health benefits, et cetera.
And I know that you were involved in taking some young people down to the State House back in December. What do you hear from these younger people about their relationship with power sources and their perception of a clean energy project like solar?
Yes, I was involved in taking those youth to Columbus in December. And one, the youth have what we refer to as like climate anxiety in a lot of cases. So their perception of like these power plants and the traditional way of getting energy from fossil fuels is that they see it in a very intersectional way that affects their health. So they're thinking about the people who actually are working in these power plants or living in the areas of the power plants. Another thing that's really that I have the opportunity to do is like I work with youth from varying backgrounds. So some of the ones that's from a more affluent background, they're worried about the more like the more climate focused pieces of like these power plants and the traditional ways of getting power. But then some of the youth that's from the more urban backgrounds, they think about it in the way of economically that their families are struggling to be able to pay their bill, their utility bills, or they have these really high utility bills and don't know what to do about it. Some of these families have to choose, of course, between paying utilities or getting new football shoes or food sometimes. So they see it from a different angle, but all of them seem to have like this climate justice and this climate anxiety and realizing that it's unfair for them to have to be stuck in the old way when there are other options such as solar to get their energy.
Shaniqua, stay with us. I want to ask Tristan about this climate anxiety and the fact that you had already hit on the fact that the Inflation Reduction Act will impact those who are interested in solar energy. Can you talk about the tax credits that are offered under the IRA?
Happy to. So the IRA currently offers and it actually extended what's called the investment tax credit, which is a 30% non-refundable tax credit for individuals who want to add solar to their roof. They can also purchase battery backups and receive, again, 30% off essentially through a non-refundable credit. It's a pretty big deal. And if you're a company or a business, there's adders to for different sectors and things. And there's also nonprofits can also take advantage of that now for the first time. So if you're a nonprofit in the area, you want to put solar on your roof, you can get a direct payment from the IRS to do that. And that's another 30% tax credit.
And so what if you're just an individual who's listening to this or who's curious about solar and you're interested in this IRA tax credit? How do you go about finding out more information?
Sure. You know, our organization, Solar United Neighbors, solarunitedneighbors.org, is a great place to find information. I'd also highly recommend that Rewire America, rewireamerica.org. It's a great nonprofit national organization we partner with. It's just a ton of great resources. You put in your address, your income level, and it'll show you all the different things you qualify for under the IRA, which could be a new furnace, it could be a new electric stove, it could be a heat pump for your house. And there's all types of different incentives structured in there, and it'll lay out all the different things you apply for and where to find those additional resources to apply.
I promised listener Debbie, who wrote in yesterday in advance of our conversation, she wrote an email and has a question. So Deborah wrote, I have solar panels on my roof because the environment is important to me. I was denied putting the panels on the front of my house by the city. My east side suburb has no ordinance about the solar panels, leaving the architectural review board with sole discretion. I hate to admit that I have given up, but without a change in the chair of the legislative committee, I don't expect it to go anywhere. Any advice from your guests?
Sure. I mean, there's 60 municipalities here in Cuyahoga County, and all of them have different varying rules on solar. I highly encourage every city and municipal official to really look into SolSmart. It's an organization that's funded by the DOE to streamline their permitting processes. It would be very helpful to the solar industry here and to the individuals in these communities if they were allowed to go solar in a very uniform way. We know there's got to be regulations, there's got to be safety rules in place to make sure these installations are happening appropriately, but there are some onerous restrictions in some cities that are just, I think, beyond what need to be.
Joel writes in, I really want solar for my roof, but my property is not ideal. When will Ohio allow for community solar? Will community solar be net metering? So we're talking about that already and kind of the piecemeal approach with community solar. Is that kind of the state of how community solar is being implemented in Ohio right now?
Yeah, so you hit on something important. There is community solar in Ohio right now in our rural electric co-ops, and then some of our muni utilities are exploring this too. Columbus just passed an ordinance that allowed for net metering in their municipal utility, and it actually calls for community solar, outlines it in their new law. But we really do need this House bill, 197, for the other parts of the state. Still, the state's covered by mostly these IOUs, which are investor-owned utilities, so the First Energies, the AEPs, the Dukes. Those territories would require state legislation. And yes, if we were to pass 197, it would be a net meter situation.
Shaniqua, how is your organization and group kind of galvanizing around House Bill 197?
So we are being supportive and like also resharing Tristan's House Solar United Neighbors, like their action alerts, but we also have created our own where we are encouraging our networks to send letters, like letters to the editors, do those type of things, also emails to Target. So we've done those. We try to remain as primarily 501c3 as possible. So in some cases, we aren't explicitly saying House Bill 197, but we're like using the words community solar instead, just also as a way so that people are more familiar with like what House Bill 197 is, and trying to make it more of like kitchen table talk where it's more communal. We are hosting different trainings for our youth to be able to talk to their families and their friends about it, like how to have the conversation, especially because the majority of the youth that I work with aren't yet of voting age. So we're talking to them about how to talk to your friends and your families that are able to vote about House Bill 197. We're doing like participating in different community events, trying to mobilize our groups and our networks to come out to these events to learn more about these bills, learn more about community solar. We are just doing a lot of different like educational tactics around community solar as a whole, and then trying to slide in that advocacy piece. And then just in general, we are always trying to keep the youth informed and empowered to be able to use their voice to advocate for these different policy changes in regards to climate justice. So we are just trying to keep turning out the information and different training opportunities for these students.
Let's take a call from Cindy, who's calling from Washington Township. Hi, Cindy. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Yes. First of all, I am so excited for this topic today. I live in Washington Township in Stark County, and Samsung has leased some land that used to be farmland for a huge solar operation out here. And there is a lot of opposition. And, you know, some of the reasons I've heard, you know, what if they start on fire? Our township fire department doesn't have the capability to put it out. When it rains, you know, that's going to leach some of the metal, you know, from the solar panels into the soil. And I would just love some answers so that I'm informed when I speak with other people about this.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks so much for your question and your thought. A great point you bring up. Kathy Ann, would you like to take a stab at answering that?
Sure. Cindy, there is a lot of misinformation out there about solar arrays, and I might almost even say disinformation in some cases. In the Knox County meetings that I went to, for example, one of the speakers was basically saying California and Texas have a lot of solar power. They also have blackouts, except the reasons for the blackouts were not solar power. They were, you know, either wildfires or they were a cold snap that affected natural gas plants. The panels, the materials are bound in there and don't leach out and have been, there have been study after study done about them. And they don't catch fire because basically what they're doing is absorbing the heat and changing it into electricity, which is then carried by conduits to the grid. The risks that people are talking about may exist on an infinitesimal level, but they are not, those are not issues that people should be necessarily be focusing on, nor are they necessarily supported by evidence.
You wanted to add to that, Tristan?
Oh, I would just say that I think there are some valid, not even criticisms, but some valid thoughts in those communities and some of the stuff that I've read to make sure that these projects, especially these large projects that are owned by corporations, they have like equitable community benefits agreements in place so the community can benefit from these large arrays. But a lot of the things you talked about, leaching chemicals, are just pure fabrications. We know where they come from. They come from the fossil fuel lobbies, the different groups who have funded and stirred up a lot of this anger in the community in order to try to sink these projects so they can maintain their stranglehold on our energy system.
And potentially, I guess your perception is feeding off maybe community resistance or the first gut kind of reaction to something very
right.
new and very different
exactly.
and their land being used in a different way. Joe from Akron wrote in saying, has anyone looked into agri-solar or agrivoltaics?
Yes.
It is talked about as a solution to the loss of farmland to solar. And so my understanding with Oak Run is it would be the largest agrivoltaic farm in the country with 2,000 of the 6,000 acres being used to be actually used for farming and for grazing for animals. So that essentially,
correct.
If I'm speaking correctly, the use of the land between the panels can actually be used for farming and for grazing for animals.
Correct. Oak Run is the largest. Agrivoltaics has also been is also part of the Knox County proposal. And I called up the sheep farmer there who entered into the agreement with Open Road Renewables. And my question was, did they call you or did you call them? He's like, I called them.
Interesting.
He's like, I need more land to graze my flock. And this is the way that I can do that. So it will actually add to his ability to expand his farm.
Kathy Ann Kowalski, reporter for the Energy News Network, Tristan Rader, Ohio Program Director for Solar United Neighbors, and of course, Shaniqua Gibson calling in, the Ohio State Director for Action for the Climate Emergency. I thank you three for this conversation this morning.
Great to be here.
Glad to be here.
Time now for a quick break. On the other side, we'll learn who made the cut for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee class of 2024. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. I do just love that song.
Good song.
Karaoke standard for me. I say that every time. It is great to play some Cher this early in the morning. But what hearing her actually means for our conversation is that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee class of 2024 has been announced. This list came out yesterday. It includes in the performer category Cher, Dave Matthews Band, Foreigner, Mary J. Blige, Ozzy Osbourne, Peter Frampton, A Tribe Called Quest, recipients of the Music Influence Awards, Alexis Korner, Big Mama Thornton, John Mayall. This year, Music Excellence Awards goes to Dionne Warwick, Jimmy Buffett, MC5, Norman Whitfield, and finally, wow, I'm going to get this.
The Ahmet Ertegun Award
goes to
Suzanne DePass. From Motown.
And with me for that amazing assist is IdeaStream senior arts reporter Kabir Bhatia, here to go over that 2024 list. So, Kabir, our favorite thing to do besides talk about our kids.
Mm-hmm, of course, talk about music.
It's to talk about music. Good to see you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It's exciting news.
Yeah.
If any of you in our audience wants to join in on the conversation, has a thought about these inductees, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Kabir, let's kick this off with Cher, a career over five decades with some choice words for the Rock Hall in the past. She's a big name at the top of the list. How does this all play out for her and the induction this year?
Well, for the ceremony, it's still too soon to know if she'll attend. They haven't announced any of that yet. I spoke with the CEO of the Rock Hall, Greg Harris, and he said only that, you know, it's interesting that all of the performers are still, I believe all of them in the performer category are still with us, still performing. So I think he has his fingers crossed that she will come here. It's one of those, I hate that I love it, I think, in her case, because last year she was on the Kelly Clarkson show, and when they found out on the air that she hadn't even been nominated, Kelly Clarkson was flabbergasted, and Cher said, I wouldn't go in if they gave me $1 million. Well, now after that she got nominated, now she's in. So let's hope that she does show up.
Do you ever wonder if a little of that is fishing, if Cher is saying, have offended, and I will not come.
I think it might be a little of that. We've seen other groups that protested, for lack of a better term, and they ended up getting in. Sometimes, though, they don't show up at all, like Todd Rundgren. He was right in Cincinnati, didn't show up. But in Cher's case, it might be a little bit. She's won a Grammy. She's won an Oscar. She's won an Emmy. So this would be the icing on the cake.
And she's sustained in power and beauty and
she's
talent.
She's still popular.
Since Sonny and Cher.
Oh, yeah. Her first. Now, remember, this is just her. Sonny is not part of this, unfortunately. Right. So that's technically a separate act. This is Cher solo. Her first solo single was 1965. It was a Bob Dylan cover. And so that's what she's getting in for. And yeah, she's been around since the early 60s. And as you said, continues killing it.
All right, next up, Dave Matthews Band. Wild, what would you say? We know how much I've loved Dave Matthews Band. Nine times.
You're excited for this, I know. You're going to go.
Well, I'm
for
thinking
this.
About my college years, to be honest. Dave Matthews Band and a couple of those albums just rode me right through my college years with joy. So that band, Kabir, famously won the fan vote in 2020 and then didn't get in, now gets inducted. What's your reaction and thoughts?
Well, I think that when you see somebody win the fan vote, if they don't get in that year, they're going to get in pretty soon after that. Dave Matthews Band, you know, has been touring. They've been part of the fabric of the music scene for, 30-some years. They're basically kind of picked up the mantle of the Grateful Dead as far as their influence, impact, the constant touring, the improvisation, of course, on stage. So I'm not surprised. I guess I'm only surprised that they didn't get in sooner. So it's nice they did.
And it's funny, too, because they have also spanned, you know, decades in their influence and kind of went for, I would even say, a little more kind of indie jam bandy.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, big arenas and every frat boy in the States wants to go see them. I mean, there's been an evolution
in who
their fan base is and the staying power that they have.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just artistically, of course, they've had that improvisational jazz influence almost sound. They can jam, basically.
Stage.
And then that translates into bigger and bigger numbers, bigger and bigger audience. And so now they're finally in.
Awesome. Yeah. All right, let's talk about classic rockers Foreigner, also inducted this year. Our producers are laughing because I am rocking out to every song.
Yes, you should.
It's a great way to start a Monday
morning. That's true. This is a good stuff.
Solar power and rock and roll power.
Two things you need, of course. As the hall has been evolving, you know, every year we're getting classic rock groups, we're getting hip hop, ultra, everything. So I think that's a good, these guys, I don't want to say fill the slot, but they are there representing the guitar-driven sound of the late 70s, the 80s. Lots of hits, of course, on top of that. And this year with the farewell tour, they're basically, I don't want to say this is the last chance for them to all be together and come here, but they'll be starting their final residency in Las Vegas right when the hall, October 19th, when the induction ceremony happens. So maybe that first show gets moved a couple days and they can make it up to Cleveland and then head back to Vegas for the final 10 shows of their career, it seems like.
All right, let's go ahead and take a call from Todd in Cleveland, one of our favorite listeners who calls in, who has a thought about the Rock and Roll Hall inductions. Todd, good morning.
Do I detect sarcasm?
No. Great joy, great joy. So, Todd, what's your thought?
I would like to know if you guys have considered, and I'm taking into consideration that there's a limited amount of funk bands, a funk band category, and also, since I was a witness to Eric B. and Rakim's first year and Tribe's first year, and I know they're both jazz-based rap groups, how did one get more consideration versus the other?
Okay, so
Great question, Todd.
Yes, this seems to come up frequently, and we kind of touched on this a second ago, but I should have expounded. And this is not written in stone. It's not as though they say when they sit down to make the ballot, the induction class, okay, we need one classic rock group. We need one group who's from England. We need one performer who's – that's not really how they do that. So I think when they look at the class, though, you want some variety. When we had our preview a few months ago of this, I was saying it was kind of – you don't want to have two groups that are very similar, and I think that's the reason that one got in, one didn't. And the example I gave was you wouldn't induct the Temptations and the Four Tops in the same year. You know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that, and they're both excellent groups. I think maybe just timing, that's my opinion, that's the reason. And something like 90% of the groups that get nominated eventually do get in. So I think we're going to see Eric B. and Rakim eventually get in. They've been nominated several times, as I'm sure you know.
And do you think that the Rock Hall historically is understanding its audience and understanding that to stay relevant and to stay a reflection of music lovers worldwide and their interests and favorite bands, that it is important to make sure that there's a diverse class and that it represents all ranges of music?
Absolutely. I mean, if it was just guitar-based groups that it had hits, there's a lot of people who would be like, well, that might not be for me. But then when you add in the Jackson 5, and then you have in, I mentioned the Four Tops, then you have the Beatles, and then I'm talking about groups who have a lot of items there.
Sure.
Then you get a good diversity of sounds, a good diversity of popular music, and people can come in and experience all of that. So if you're not interested in seeing Elvis's jumpsuit, you might be interested in seeing Eddie Van Halen's guitar, you know, something like that.
All right. Next up, Mary J. Blige.
You should be doing this part yourself. My goodness, I've never seen you like this.
I'm your hype girl.
There you go. That makes sense.
All right, let's talk about Mary J. Blige. And one of those performers that has the cred to get into the Rock Hall, provides some diversity in terms of being a woman of color, and just a great hip-hop artist.
So how many people that we hear now on the radio have records that sound, I'm not saying they're copying it, but clearly sound like that's the DNA of the current records are what we just heard.
Yeah.
And that's really what the Rock Hall is all about, the influence. Her influence from 30-some years ago of being, as you said, being a woman of color, and that sound that I can't even describe it. Because it's just, it was otherworldly at the time, and now you hear it, not everywhere, but certainly in a lot of current music. So the influence alone, I think, gets her. And then on top of that, you add her success, her critical acclaim. She was a slam dunk, and again, one of those that I was surprised wasn't inducted sooner.
Frequent emailer and listener Tom wrote in an email that poignantly says, Ozzy. So that can only mean one thing. Let's hear a little Ozzy. So for diehard fans like Tom, Kabir, what are your thoughts? We know that Ozzy Osbourne's had health struggles, getting a little more feeble in his older age. Do you think there's a prospect of him coming to perform?
I would hope so, but a lot of times, like Tina Turner a few years ago was having health trouble, and she sent a very nice video, but she wasn't able to actually travel over here. She, though, lived in Europe. He, at least, is in the U.S. a lot of the time, as far as I know. So fingers crossed that he's able to attend. It's always nice to see these folks, especially if this might be, one of his final public appearances. But for the people who are wondering, he is technically already in with Black Sabbath once. This is for his solo career. His amazing guitarist, Randy Rhoads, got in a few years ago. So it's nice that now he's getting the nod, and hopefully he's able to make it here in person in October.
Let's move on to Peter Frampton.
Come on!
So, Kabir, has there been a pretty vocal contingent calling for Peter Frampton's induction, and particularly after he performed with Sheryl Crow, right?
Yeah. So this is I'll talk politics now for a second.
Sure.
If you look back at political conventions, there's been many times where somebody gives an address or they appear at a convention. Suddenly, 4 years later, they're the nominee. It happened with President Kennedy, President Reagan, President Clinton. Look up Clinton's speech. It was hilarious. Hilarious in how long it went. But all of them then became very successful presidents. And I think the same thing happens here. Pat Benatar was at one of the inductions a few years ago. Then she got in after that. Paul McCartney inducted John Lennon, and then he got in. He was supposed to get in right after that. There's a whole thing you can look up online. But I think that that really happened in this case. And his early albums, before Frampton Comes Alive, were reissued last year on vinyl, finally. So I think that really helped get him back on people's radar.
We've got Jim calling in from Cleveland with what I believe is what we call a hot take.
Oh,
Jim,
boy.
Go ahead.
I guess a hot take. I respect Dave Matthews Band, but there's also another band which we're forgetting, which has more sold out shows at MSG than anyone, and that's
Fish
with a PH. It's ridiculous that their hot dog is there. It's like having Pete Rose's bat there, but he's not in the Hall of Fame. It's ludicrous. They need to be in. And then I will say one more band, which in a couple of years we'll be up there, and that's the Tedeschi Trucks Band. So those are my thoughts on those two.
Awesome, Jim. I think your point is well taken, and one of our lead producers, Drew, stands by that comment completely.
Yeah.
I know they're playing the Sphere right now. I've got some old
yeah.
college friends who just checked out a performance there, and it looked incredible.
I'm sure.
And talk about a jam band, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I'll be honest, Fish is one of those on the list everyone has of why aren't they in, should they get in. They've been very high on my list for a long time. Every time I think about it, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm surprised Fish isn't in. So you're good point, Jim.
Last but not least, we got to talk about A Tribe Called Quest. Again, if we want to talk about Jenny's experience, Low End Theory was a big album for me as well.
Yo, Fife, you remember that routine that we used to make spiffy like Mr. Clean?
A tidbit, a spidgin. I don't get the message, so you got to
okay.
run the pigeon.
You're on point, Fife.
All the time, Tip.
You're on point, Fife.
What are your thoughts?
How can you not put a group in when you hear just that snippet? And their whole aesthetic of being very, as we've mentioned earlier, jazz influenced. I hate to use the word retro, but in the 90s, they were looking back to the 70s and beyond for samples. That album, the Low End Theory, is very complex technologically, almost like Paul's Boutique in the level of engineering alone.
And the samples.
And the samples.
Especially at a time, I think, like NWA was big, and you just
right.
had this really hard rap, and there was a jazzy, soulful vibe to Tribe Called Quest.
And it wasn't.
And it was joyful.
It was joyful. It wasn't the machismo that we hear in a lot of hip-hop of that time. And it still sounds timeless, possibly because when it came out, it was already somewhat retro, and I think that's the reason that they continue to endure. That album is amazing. It was just reissued on vinyl as well, so
ooh.
Yeah, it's nice that they got in.
Do you have a big vinyl collection?
I have one record. No, I have several, and I have that one. Yeah, I'm going to go listen to it after this.
I was going to say, what's the one record?
Yeah, it's me singing. You don't want that.
That's great.
Yeah.
You force the kids to listen,
it's
right?
It's my comeback album. It's called Kabir's Back, and the front cover is a photo of me with my head turned to the camera.
Oh, gosh, Kabir. The dad jokes that
yes.
always land. Okay, we've got a couple minutes, so why don't you kind of tell us about these other awards that aren't necessarily inductees but you think are important to mention.
So there's 8 in the performer and then 8 in these other categories. Musical influence is just that, people who were influential. Big Mama Thornton, if you saw the Elvis movie, she wrote Hound Dog. She wrote many other blues on Ball and Chain. And then she passed away kind of forgotten after a little revival in the 60s, 70s, and she's definitely an influence. Elvis, Janis Joplin. nice that she's getting in. Alexis Korner and John Mayall, they were part of that early 60s British blues boom. They were never huge names over here. John Mayall is still with us, so hopefully he attends. But their backing groups, or the people that they nurtured, was members of the Rolling Stones later, members of Fleetwood Mac later, members of Cream, Eric Clapton, very well known, one of their sidemen. So the two of them discovered, kind of, or gave these guys their first break. So they definitely deserve to be in. And then musical excellence is another category.
You got 30 seconds.
Dionne Warwick, how can you not induct her? MC5, punk, proto-punk pioneers. They were at the 68 Democratic Convention. Jimmy Buffett, amazing that he's finally getting in. He's like an industry unto himself, as we know. Norman Whitfield, he did some of the Temptations' biggest records the second half of their career. Psychedelic Soul, he reinvented them. And then Suzanne DePass, big-time Motown executive, very successful, and moved them into TV production, which was also very successful.
I see producer Jay Shaw vigorously nodding her head to MC5. I think she's got—
Is she from Detroit?
She's got that hard punk.
I can see that. Okay.
Yeah,
my kids love that.
She's a true, true fan.
Good stuff.
Senior arts reporter Kabir Bhatia, I appreciate you coming in. Real quickly, the induction ceremony.
Yes.
If people want to get tickets, how's that going
to
work?
If you're a member, you'll get to get them a little bit earlier than others. It's going to be at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse, October 19th. Keep watching the Rock Hall page for details.
That's a hot ticket. I want to go.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks so much, Kabir.
Thank you.
Great time. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter now, X at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_ or on Instagram @JennyHamillIdeaStream. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we continue our Earth Week series of environmental stories by focusing, this is an important one, on the concept of zero waste. We'll talk about recycling and overall efforts to reduce our consumption. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast. You can hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. As we close today, some music from John Mayall and his tune, Room to Move. He was one of the Rock Hall's Musical Influence awardees this year. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and I will speak with you again tomorrow.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rude, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Auble provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast. And our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.